Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Zimmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hey, hey.
And we're here to answer more of your cycling and triathlon related questions. You can submit them to us at trainerroad.com/podcast. Before we get into the questions, we have a number of things to cover. First, it's getting super close. It's only 2 weeks away. You can RSVP up on our Facebook page. You'll see. You can go on there. RSVP for a live podcast recording. You actually get to see us live.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, join us live, actually, in San Francisco at the Rafa Cycle. Yeah,
most of us.
True
story. Important.
Yeah, Chad won't be with us.
I don't want to go all fanboy here, but at some point you guys need to let Matt know that I've read all of his books except for The Iron War.
We're going to be talking to Matt Fitzgerald, and he's an endurance sports writer. He's written on a number of different things, but we're going to be focusing the conversation on the psychology of performance in endurance sports. So how to get more out of your performance by engaging the noodle upstairs. So he's a great resource on the topic. We're going to ask our questions. You can come and ask your questions. Join us live at the Rafa Cycle Club, San Francisco, Saturday, November 4th. We're even going to go for a group ride after.
And it's 2017.
Yes.
There's probably someone in 2018 going, oh, sweet. Don't show up.
Yeah. And it's going to be a ton of fun. We're going to do a group ride up to the Marin Headlands thereafter. Once again, go onto our Facebook page, RSVP, let us know, because we're going to have burritos, by the way.
Are we?
Yeah, we're going to have burritos. They have
people like it if you have punch and pie.
Yeah, exactly.
More people come.
Yeah, there'll be cafe. There's a cafe right there in the club. It's awesome. It's a great place to be. Going to be an awesome ride, right across the Golden Gate Bridge up to Mount Tam.
All speeds welcome.
All speeds. It's a no-drop ride. Yeah. So it's going to be a ton of fun. Join us Saturday, November 4th for that one. It's going to be at 9 a.m. But you can get the details on Trainer Road's Facebook page, and you can RSVP there.
I just have to say it. Mm-hmm. Can I say what we're doing?
Please.
Right now?
Yeah.
We're recording ourselves. Potentially going... Well, no, we're going live.
We are.
We're going to go live. This one might be live later on Facebook. Hi, everybody. I just waved to the camera. I don't know if I'm supposed to look at the camera or just look into Chad's eyes. We're usually...
Please do that the whole time.
We're usually not this close to each other.
It's like in Talladega Nights.
Pretty cozy.
Nate doesn't know what to do with his hands.
Yeah. So.
The camera distorts, so we have to sit impossibly close to one another.
Yeah, if you can see this camera, watch this. Jonathan looks really small now.
It's okay. True.
All right.
It's true.
Okay. We'll get back to the podcast.
Stay on track.
Nate's very excited. We came back from Kona just recently. We were there for the Ironman World Championships. We had our own self-declared world championship of sorts, if you will. We climbed Mount Akea. We started in Waikoloa, the Waikoloa Beach, I should say, not the village. We started at the water, dipped our wheels in, and then climbed our way 14,000 feet all the way up to the summit.
We meaning you.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Well, Chad and I started, and we had Jake, a Trainer Road user, join us as well, which was a ton of fun. Stuart, another Trainer Road user, intended to join us, but he got his days wrong, so he just did it solo the day before.
But he did do it.
He did. He got it done. And we started out, it was toasty, and then it got cold, but we learned a lot of things about this, because it's tough when you're... So like we put this into Best Bike Split, and we were looking at like what the best way to pace it was, and it was pretty conservative, but I paced like I would say even more conservatively, and I regret that. I think I should have gone harder earlier, because once I got up there that high, you know, and up above like 11,000 feet all the way up to 13,600, which is where the summit is, I just couldn't press the pedals hard anyway. There was just so little oxygen to deal with that it was just really tough. So I kind of looked back and I thought, man, I should have pushed a little harder.
That's a good question, Chad. And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but if you are doing a climb where you change elevations, mm-hmm. and so in Jonathan's case, you're thinking that if you would have, let's say, done 20 more watts at a lower elevation, mm-hmm. as you got to the higher elevation, you would have been just as bad. But could he have been even in a bigger hole? You know, and been even more to 20 watts lower.
I was kicking that around on the ride up, trying to think about that. And I kind of wondered if Best Bike Split took that into account. Did they account for
elevation? I think to a certain degree, but I'm not sure to the exact level.
Yeah, I don't have the answer to it. I don't know. Yeah. And this is new territory in terms of experiential data.
I don't know either.
It's interesting. The same thing was pouring through my mind. And the one thing I can say is that I didn't feel the fatigue that you feel like your legs are just cooked. When I was up there, I just felt overall fatigue. Like and my heart rate, I didn't have a heart rate monitor on, but I could hear my heart rate in my head just you know, the whole time. It was just through the roof, right? When you're up at that high of elevation, and my breathing the whole time at the same pace, more or less, was controlled. Like I could define the rate at which I was breathing. It wasn't, and I could carry on like a decent conversation. But then once I got up there.
But based on other things you've told us, I don't think you suffer the same sort of effects of altitude as a lot of people do.
It's true. Yeah. Elevation. I've never had, a lot of backcountry skiing tends to be in the high country for me. And I do not see the detriment that most people experience.
My pacing strategy. So I didn't do it because I got food poisoning. I was like in the ER, like
conveniently. I'm surprised. We've said this before, but I am shocked that you even made it to the trip.
So. Conveniently, no. I know. It sucked.
Yeah.
I was in the support car, but I got to be in. Oh, shout out to Alex.
Yes, from Big Island Bike Tours.
Candelario, nice job.
Ex pro ripper of a cyclist.
Super fun guy to hang out with. Yeah. The latter half of the ride that I didn't do.
I think I was in the car before with 9 hours. Got to hear all these pro stories, which is really fun. Yeah. But if you go to Kona. He owns a bike tour company and Big Island Bike Tours. You call them up and they'll take you mountain biking. He does a Mauna Kea tour. You don't have to do Mauna Kea though. He has all different levels, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I'm sure he could take you to really cool places.
Shout out to him. But going back, my pacing strategy was, I was probably over-optimistic, but I was saying if I could hold 250 for the whole climb, and then I was going to, as elevation got higher, reduce my wattage, and just know that in my head.
You would have been forced to anyway.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't have been forced to, but there's a difference between being forced to and planning ahead.
Sure.
Yeah, being proactive about it, because then you don't put yourself in a hole.
And it's a mental thing. For me, it was going to be a mental thing, because I know like when I got to 10,000 feet, if I'm thinking, oh, my target is 250, but I can only put out 220, I'm suddenly like, oh, I'm behind. This is really hard. Mm-hmm. But if my target's 220, I'm hitting 220, I'm on track. This is wonderful. What a great day. Mm-hmm. Chad didn't have a great day. We have a picture of him in our Slack channel. he is biking up the hill and he's got a big frowny face on. Yeah. It looks like the sad panda. The sad cat meme.
Yeah.
There's like a grumpy cat online. Well, that is Chad.
Just a couple things really quick pretty on flattering. Pacing specific. So we talked about pacing in general, but pacing, if you're ever going to do Mauna Kea, which I know is a small sliver, but you really should. This is quite the, if you're into the, cycling bucket list stuff, this is definitely one
pretty
for it.
Epic endeavor, especially considering the conditions. I mean, we started in 90 degrees, high humidity. It was uncomfortably hot, and then it got uncomfortably cold and windy and rainy.
But if it's a bucket list thing, it's one and done, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would like to go back to get a better time, but I don't think I'd like to go back for like the experience. Like I feel like the bucket list experience part is crossed off.
So what else about pacing?
So pacing specifically on this one, we thought in my mind, even looking at the elevation profile, I thought that once we got to what they call Saddle Road on this one, which is basically the saddle between two gigantic volcanoes, one being Mauna Kea, one being Mauna Loa. I thought that it would be a consistent gradient, but really not too bad. I thought that the climbing would kind of mellow out there before it really kicks up on Mauna Kea Access Road, but that was not the case. Saddle Road was one of the hardest parts because the wind was about, 20 to 30 miles an hour, probably in our faces the whole time. And it was really, really steep and it just kept climbing. So
it was a hard day. So it didn't really affect pacing so much as it just increased the time you're going to be out on the road.
Yeah.
Which was a little deflating knowing that you still have several hours of climbing.
We don't want to do epic race report about, it was windy and rainy. But what do you do when, so we hit an unexpected, I was in a car, unexpected headwind, right? Yeah. For a long time that made something longer. So if you are pacing.
This is why you pace conservatively.
Yeah.
To account for things like this.
Yeah, because it's always easier. I mean, it's so much easier. And I think even a lot of world championships, like in running and in cycling, are always negative splits. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to go like at a 49% for the first half and then a 51.
Yes.
But the only difference in this one is the elevation change. So it makes, we're not sure how to pace that. But that's like the takeaway is conditions could change and you might be out there longer. And if you, the difference between a 6 hour and a 6:45 is a big difference.
Yeah, when you know you're going to be on the road for between 6 and 7 hours, I mean, err on the side of caution. Even if you're on a good day and you head out and you're feeling super good, know that you have many hours ahead of you and this climb only gets worse. Conditions only get worse.
Yeah, and in terms of equipment on this as well, I think that these big days, we learned that in this case with Mauna Kea, that I've at least felt a wind vest and just some good arm warmers were plenty fine.
Even though the temperatures were low, it's you're not moving very fast. So we got away with a lot less clothing than I thought we'd need.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be sufficient. So I think that in that case, you could probably just carry that with you. But the weather can change to be much worse than we had, even though it was like at the top, it was just above freezing and it was really windy and rainy. But still, I think that that's something that we learned is that you can get away with a little bit less than we thought.
A lot less.
And the only thing too is we didn't have a downhill. So normally if you're riding, it's the climb you're warm and then the downhill you freeze. But we drove down, so that's why.
Yeah, and then last bit on equipment in terms of the bike, we did a 26-tooth chainring up front, 10-42 in the rear. And yes, I did say 26 up front. It's really tiny.
It was necessary.
But yeah, it really helped. And the reason for that is because 5 miles of this climb, people call it gravel. I would call it sand. It's not really gravel. It's like sand that kind of gets packed down. There's no organic matter. It's just kind of gravelly volcanic rock sand. So it doesn't pack down very well. And if in our case, we ran 30C slicks because Chad and I tried to kind of run a compromise tire, give us some flotation with bigger volume on that sandy stuff, but not detract on the road. And I think it was a good choice. That said, it's because we had the gearing. So I think those slick tires are just fine. If you have a 26-tooth chainring or really low gearing, I think it ended up being like a 6.4 ratio.
It's also raining up there, so there's a bit of extra traction.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, to a degree.
A bit.
Yeah, it's kind of, once again, it doesn't necessarily pack down very well with organic matter like most dirt would. But anyways, that allowed, if you have slicks and you're lacking traction, you need to be able to spin so you don't put out as much torque, right? And that's what I found in this case. So if you find yourself in a situation where you have way too heavy of gearing and you're going to be going off-road on loose terrain, then you're going to want to go with a tire that can give you more traction. But if you can afford it, go with a tire with less traction and lower gearing. It's another option.
That's a takeaway for all mountain biking or cross or gravel.
Totally.
Chad, I want to talk to you about something. You, as we went up, you kept having to get off your bike because you had back problems. Mm-hmm. And you've had back problems for a while. And I think, probably listening to this podcast, you're not the only one with back problems.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to ask you, can you describe your back problems and then what are you going to do to solve them?
So what I've been doing, and basically my low back just tightens up. So lumbar spine just gets worse and worse, forces me to sit in a more upright posture and to get out of the saddle and stretch occasionally. But either way, I can tolerate it for so long. So a couple hours and then it starts to get to a point where it just gnaws and my power just declines until I get off the bike and do, you know, a quad stretch. So basically my hip flexors, my quadriceps, everything in the front of my body from being bent over the bike, bent at a desk, bent behind a car, seated for most of my life, really, kind of starts to rear its ugly head. And it just can only take it for so long, especially when you're in a seated position and you're putting out power. So I'm not just sitting there, but I'm actually trying to work in that position and stressing muscles in a lengthened state or a shortened state, whatever. It all combines to create quite a lot of back pain. And it gets to a point where it's unbearable and I have to get up and stretch. Mm. And once it starts, it's really only a kind of a slippery slope from that point forward. And I have to get off and stretch more frequently. So I'm trying to address it by opening up the anterior aspect of my body. So my hip flexors and my quads, especially via mostly foam rolling, but also trigger point release. I'm trying a few things, trying to pin down, you know, what exactly helps it and what doesn't. And the rolling does seem to help it when I roll consistently. But if I get away from it, then basically what happened with Mauna Kea.
The tricky part with this climb too is that it was pretty much the worst case scenario for that sort of a problem.
No,
because
relief.
You could never stop pedaling. Yeah. If you did, you just stopped and fell over.
So Chad, he bailed up for like 4 hours and 45 minutes or something.
Almost made my 5 hour mark.
Yeah. But what, so a lot of people too, as they get older, they start buying bikes that are not as aggressive because of that. Like they want to do long rides and they buy like a Roubaix or a
Damani,
that's what you have. Mm-hmm. Or two, like you were on a cross bike, the Specialized Crux, you could be on the Diverge, which is more relaxed. Mm-hmm. I know too, you are a longtime racer in aggressive bikes. Mm-hmm. Is there like a mental thing too to be like on a less aggressive race bike?
No, it really doesn't come down to that. I still think my body is fully capable of doing what I want it to do. I just think I'm not addressing actual issues as diligently as I should.
And I think that your stack height was plenty fine in
relation to your ski height.
I actually
bumped the stack height up in anticipation of this climb.
I noticed
up a couple spacers. Yeah,
by the way.
Just to hopefully postpone the, not the cramping, the tightness a little longer.
You should have rode with no handlebars.
I should.
Just like sit
great,
up straight.
Great idea. Next time. Solution.
As he climbs, you just,
you know, I actually did, there was one flat part on Saddle Road and I spent 5 minutes sitting up with no hands on the bars because I thought that, and it was a spot where I could actually, it wasn't flat, it was still going uphill, but it was 5 minutes where I just stood up and I pedaled, and it was for that purpose because I thought chances are I'm not going to be able to stretch much later.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
I was able to get it stretched.
Nutrition, what'd you guys do?
I used UCAN Superstarch, and I had two bottles, and I had them scheduled for, you know, I started with one, and then I wanted one at 2 hours and 4 hours, and unfortunately, I missed a feed because there was a bit of miscommunication, and or due to my right or my left turn when it should have been a right turn, I tacked on about an extra half hour's worth of riding and car shuttling back to where I missed the turn. So that created quite an issue in terms of our support. So Jonathan's way up the road, and I'm about 30 minutes back. So up until that point, we were only a minute gapped. Really easy to support both of us, but once that happened, everything kind of
Got more.
But anyways, you like Superstarch, and
it was working super well. But when I get an hour late feed, it was very hard to come back from that.
Yeah, but let's just Superstarch though
worked well.
It's very popular, and it's usually in people use Superstarch for Ironmans, half Ironmans, long stuff. They usually don't do it like, I'm going to do a 2 hour road race. Mm-hmm. They usually don't use Superstarch.
I'm pretty sure it's meant for sub threshold intensities. Yeah. I don't know that they expect you to use something like that for a highly glycolytic criterium or a mountain bike cross country race sort of
thing. Can you describe what Superstarch is?
It's largely cornstarch.
You put it in a bottle, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a really fine powder. It mixes up. It's really quite concentrated, quite heavy. It's not the easiest thing to drink, especially when it warms up. Hmm. So
what do you, how many calories do you put in a bottle?
Oh man, I can't remember. It's two scoops. They have recommendations on the bottle for planning on using it for 4 hours, you do three scoops, between two and three, mm-hmm. two scoops, whatever. I didn't even look at what the caloric breakdown, or I did, but I don't remember right now.
I know another one that I have used before is called CarboPro. I think it's called CarboPro. It's Superstarch says they have a special way they manufacture things. CarboPro has none of that. It's much cheaper, but you know, you can make a 1,000-calorie bottle. I mentioned this before, mm-hmm. which I've used before for like a half Ironman or something.
Their claim to fame is that it just releases more slowly, more evenly. It doesn't spike your insulin, your blood sugar. It keeps a more even keel energy release.
And Jonathan, I don't think I've ever seen you eat as much as on this ride.
Yeah, I didn't want to bonk. I ended up taking in Scratch for my hydration. I didn't do
Same
any
here.
Water.
I use Scratch also.
Yeah, no water at all, just Scratch. Because I figured if I'm going to be drinking and sweating this much, I need to be putting some electrolytes in at all, or as regularly as possible. And then for food, I had two Clif bars. They were the coconut almond butter Clif bars. I had three picky bars, so they were the cookie donuts flavor, and those are about 200 calories each on those bars, and same with the Clif bars. I had a whole package of Shot Blocks, and I had three packets of Clif gel.
Yeah, so a lot. And yep. You had no problems with nutrition, stomach.
In terms of like energy, no problem there. And I did shift things. Ideally, I would have had rice cakes or something like that earlier on, especially because the effort was pretty low. So it would have been easy to digest that sort of stuff. But I shifted the gels and everything else toward later.
But the simple fact is we needed a lot of food because we were doing a lot of work. I mean, this mm-hmm. wasn't like a mass art road race where you could sit in. I mean, we were constantly working. There was mm-hmm. one stretch that maybe lasted five minutes where we didn't have to pedal. The rest of it... You're on it.
The other takeaway that people might not realize is that this is constant intensity, it's a lot easier to eat food than mm-hmm. if you're like in a road race or something. And I think too, there's less opportunity for upset stomach where you eat a bunch and then like, oh my gosh, the whole race just blows up and goes really fast.
Yeah.
Super steady.
Exactly. And that's why too, Ironman athletes, it's really super steady, probably even less wattage than you guys were doing during the bike ride mm-hmm. relatively to their fitness level because they have to run a marathon afterwards.
Right.
And they're trying to get in more because they have to run a marathon afterwards.
I should mention that my other go-to food were these little coconut cake mini donuts.
Oh, yeah.
And this was based on some awesome advice from Matt Lieto, who said, imagine you're on a long ride, you start to bonk, you head into the convenience store, what's the first thing you grab? So I went and bought Coke and little mini donuts, and I got to say, it kind of saved my butt.
My nutrition plan, I didn't eat for a couple of days, and then I didn't bring any food for this 9-hour car ride. But Alex had, I think I ate almost a whole bag of Maui chips.
Nice.
And it was hot. I was just watching you guys work out eating potato chips.
It was a 6-hour and 48-minute effort to the top for me. So.
And you got third on the KOM.
I did, but we can cut that down a whole lot more with definitely the weather was a factor, but also just the pacing and my fitness coming into this isn't really.
And you forgot your head unit and your power meter didn't work.
It worked for about 5 seconds.
Yeah, it said your average power was 2 watts. Mm-hmm. So next year we're doing it again, or I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And Jonathan's gonna.
I'm gonna support
me, and I'm gonna beat Jonathan's time. Yeah. Call it right now.
He'll be able to. definitely will. So that's what we learned from big epic rides like that. Hopefully that can help you, give you some idea, especially for Mount Ikea, but anything else that you have. After the ride, we had a Trainer Road user dinner. We had a handful of users with us that came, or I should say athletes. User sounds weird, right? But a handful of people that use Trainer Road, they came with us to dinner at the Kona Brewing Company. A ton of good time. Yeah, it was good to actually get to see some people, you know, being a software company, we don't get to interact.
Yeah, we had some good FaceTime with our subscribers. It was really nice.
We like it when you come up and talk to us. And I want to tell a quick story, then we'll move on to some actually learning stuff. This is a cool story.
Perfect.
So we're at Kona Brewing Company, which is semi-famous place there. We had, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 people at our table. And one of our users, let's call him Brandon.
Yeah.
That's his real name. he couldn't make it. He was doing some business stuff and we're eating dinner and we had just ordered. And he texted me and he says, "Hey, you guys still at Kona Brewing? Do you have room for two more? Crowey and I are coming." And for those of you who don't know, Crowey is Craig Alexander, 3-time Ironman champ at Kona. Like, he's won a ton of Ironmans, but he won at Kona 3 times and he had the course record. Mm-hmm. So it was so cool to be able to tell the other subscribers, "Hey, Crowey's coming. You guys mind?"
Well, and get to hear the stories too.
Yeah, he came totally chill and he just told us all these stories about it. And it's really cool to kind of, very nice guy.
Yeah.
It was a really fun dinner. So if you hang out with us, who knows, we'll show up.
That's the truth. So thanks to everybody that spent time with us and saw us there in Kona. That was a ton of fun. And we're looking forward to doing that at some events next year. We actually have some pretty big plans in the works for that sort of a thing. So we'll keep you posted. Let's get straight into the questions. Jason's, he says, "As always, 5 stars of the podcast and Trainer Road. I just finished your last podcast, the prequel to Cross Vegas 2017, if you will. You all didn't mention your gearing for Cross. What did you ride on this year, and what is your reasoning behind the gearing that you all choose?" Let's handle that one first. He has another question, but let's cover the gearing first.
So I want to start this, and I've thought about this a lot, is that my cross bike for me is set up to be both a cross bike and a gravel race bike.
Okay. So in which respects?
And the two things on it that make it a gravel race bike is I have a 42 in the front and a 42 in the rear.
Okay.
So usually I have a 10-42 in the rear. Usually that wouldn't be so big in the rear for cross. We have a 1x setup. And I don't think I actually need it in cross. When I go to Sacramento and they have a great cross series there, I don't go on that. Even in Cross Vegas, I had, you know, my derailleur hanger was bent. I couldn't go into my 42.
Right.
That was fine. Reno Cross, I think the guy who puts it on listens to this, but they're a little crazy courses.
They're fun.
And I do need them there. And then
I like it.
The having a dropper post, I don't think I really need a dropper post. I've never used it in Sacramento. I don't need it in Cross Vegas. Reno courses, some of them, I do need it.
Yeah.
But on a gravel race, you actually need it too because it's steeper descents and better handling.
Do you feel the same, Chad?
No, I think I'm done with the dropper post actually.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's, you know, we've talked about the dropper post, and I know that you asked about gearing, but I feel like the dropper post is useful in very rare situations. It's useful, but when it is useful, it can gain you a serious advantage. But in most cases, if you're racing a typical cross course, it's not going to be that great of an advantage. And something that I've noticed, at least in the past, even in the past year, is that promoters or organizers are using more 2-barrier setups than 1-barrier setups, and they're putting them closer and closer together to kind of force you to be, really, if you try to bunny hop it, you have to slow down so much so that when you bunny hop, you don't fly into the second barrier, that it really doesn't necessarily end up being faster in a lot of cases. It depends. It's an edge case. But so the dropper can help, but it certainly does come at a weight penalty, about 3/4 of a pound.
I'm going to say, though, that Chad, you're not going to use it, but also your new Canyon hardtail mountain bike is your gravel bike, much like Carl Decker, who wins these things. So you don't, you know what I mean? Like
I'm talking strictly in a cross, cyclocross sense. Mm-hmm. I figure if it can be done and, you know, it's been done until now without a dropper post, then I'd like to try to figure out how to do it that way.
Yeah.
That just goes to my point is I also don't think, besides a couple courses in Reno, I don't think I need a dropper post. And I am like the worst, right? Of bike handling. Yeah. So if you know what I mean, but I'm going to keep it on, or it's easy enough to switch out. I might just switch it out.
Yeah.
Do you say how much weight?
It usually comes at about 3/4 of a pound.
Oh, I was hoping more.
No. No, that's about it.
Eight pounds.
The seat posts that we have weigh, I think, about 420 grams. But if you subtract the weight of your other seat post, it's really not a whole lot of a difference really in the end. But I'm going to keep mine on because I do think that there are situations where it could be an advantage, and I'm not sure that there's too much of a disadvantage there. So in terms of gearing, though, now there are situations with having our gearing like we do with a 1-to-1 ratio where it is massively beneficial. I'm thinking of run-ups specifically in spots where people end up having to get off and run. I've been able to ride up those because of the gearing that we have, save energy, and save a lot of time. Now, keep in mind, a lot of courses don't have run-ups like that. They don't have loose, steep, or technical run-ups. Yeah,
there are some things that we have the option of riding because we have this gearing. And I think that's kind of cool. And it's, I mean, why not? If it's there, why not? It's an extra cog on your cog set. It's not a weight penalty. It doesn't affect the shifting. I mean, there's really no reason not to have it.
Yeah.
Small weight penalty.
You know,
but not so small.
I mean, a gulp of water small.
The gaps between the gears on that cassette, sure, are going to be more than an 1136. But in cross, I don't notice that being too big of a problem. If you're riding a course like Cross Vegas that has like drafting and everything else, then maybe that's you could have a little bit more than that, but I've never noticed that being a problem. So much like the gearing, how you said, if you have it there, it's good to have in reserve. And that's kind of how I feel in the dropper post. It's helpful, but certainly I wouldn't deem it necessary.
Do you know Keegan Swenson's gearing?
He usually runs an 1136, and then he runs somewhere around a 42 up front usually. And in terms of tires, because you also asked what tires he used, because we got distracted and talked about Nate's flat tire and the whole debacle that happened there. He uses the Maxxis Speed Terrains. That's what he uses. So, and he ends up running file treads usually at most cross races. So he's an incredible bike handler, keep in mind. So let's get into Michael's question. He says, "Hello guys, thanks for a 5-star podcast. I actually have two questions in one. During the race season, I'm usually riding around 7 to 10 hours per week, but the season is nearing its end here in Denmark. I've recently started the build phase. So my question is, can I expect gains even though my riding time decreases from 7 to 10 hours per week outside down to 3.8 hours per week inside as laid out in your training plan?" It's a common question that we get a lot, people asking that sort of a thing. He then adds, he says, "I can't get my body or mind through more than 1.5 hours of work inside on a trainer. What's your take on what to do?" What do you guys say? I mean,
it's going to depend largely on the composition. I mean, you can't compare the two. If you're doing 7 to 10 hours of intensity, which is highly unlikely, then 3.8 hours obviously isn't going to bring gains. But I'm guessing those 7 to 10 hours aren't spent drilling it all the time. There's probably a lot of filler work in there, a lot of aerobic endurance, stuff that isn't exactly necessary in terms of performance improvement. The 3.8 hours that you will spend indoors will be focused entirely on that. So it's going to be, you're basically shifting from quantity to quality in terms of focus.
Yeah. And I would add to that, even if you're hammering it theoretically for 7 to 10 hours purely outside, chances are it lacks proper structure anyway. And the proper structure of rest and work and making sure that it's trending appropriately, that's where you really start to see the improvement.
But still though, 3.8 isn't that much inside.
It's not. So it remains to be seen. Yeah. This may not be enough stimulus to actually make you a stronger rider. You're going to have to figure that out.
He might need to do more. And if he's doing, so let's say we'll get strategies about doing more than 90 minutes, but let's say you're doing 90 minutes, man,
more days,
mm-hmm. 90 minutes. That is, if you do 5 90-minute minutes of trainer road rides, you're going to be fast.
Yeah. So, and something to add to this is I would start lower perhaps than you think you need. If you're coming from an outdoor unstructured background, we see a lot of people jump in and, you know, they may say, well, I'm doing, you know, 8 hours outside, so I will do a training plan that has about the same time. And once again, this is all purely structured work, so it can be a bit overwhelming. So I would recommend starting with a low volume plan and then seeing if you can bump up to the mid volume, because putting yourself in a hole early on can always be, it's tougher to pull yourself out of than just stepping up.
Here's my new strategy too. I can do 90 minutes, like no problem. Mm-hmm. I can do 2 hours too, like probably on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. When you say I can do, are you saying like mentally you can handle it physically?
Yeah. Mentally, yeah. Like 2 hours and I'm not like.
Yeah, I got to say that does come with time. I mean, yeah. The idea of a 2-hour trainer ride years ago was unfathomable.
Me too.
Unfathomable. I can't say it. Unfathomable. And now it's commonplace.
My first trainer ride before trainer roading, before I met you, Chad, I think I tried to do an hour and about 15 minutes came in and I quit. I'm like, this is, I used to hate the trainer. Yeah. I even tried to buy like outdoor lights to do nighttime riding in the winter and thermal stuff. And then somebody told me about, well, there'll be drunk drivers or something like that. And I was like, I'm going to get hit by a car. And I would try so hard. And then I found your class and that was like the Evolution Trainer Road. But it's weird when you have goals, it's a lot easier to last that time. Yeah, but the new thing that I'm doing is I have a lot of, right now in cross season, I have short, intense intervals, you know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes or something like that. And then a good amount of rest, maybe 3 minutes rest. And I am switching between music and a movie. I'm just watching Mindhunters on Netflix, which is pretty good.
Same thing.
Yeah. So it's cool. On my iPad, I'll watch Netflix. And then when the interval starts, I'll go to Spotify and I have like a ride playlist. And there's something like, I start 30 seconds before and there's something mentally that gets into you when here comes the work and here comes the loud music.
It's like a mental switch.
Exactly. Like it's work time.
Yeah.
And then and then it's rest time and then it's work time. And if I can watch in 2 hours, it takes, you know, I can watch a 40-minute show in about 2 hours because of all the switching back and forth. But it's I kind of like that.
I should put up a Spotify playlist that I've been building up recently too, up on Trainer Road. That'd be fun for people to listen to. You can find our playlists on there. If you go onto Spotify and just search for Trainer Road, you should be able to find some of the playlists that we've published, and I'll get to work on publishing some more. It's some punk rock stuff and hard stuff, but it's good. I like it. His next question, he says, if I want to mix my training up a bit and do some strength training, what should I do and when should I do it in relation to my training plan? Thanks in advance. And again, for an awesome podcast.
Yeah, we can maybe dive a little bit more deeper into this at a later date. This is just a good opportunity for us to plug an upcoming blog post and video that's going to go along with it.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and I don't really know how to cover this without demonstrating these things, but it's a breakdown of three bodyweight exercises and two weight strength training exercises that if I had to whittle it down to just five exercises, these are the ones I would choose.
Okay.
And it has a bit of a cyclocross slant, but they're also pretty cycling general.
Perfect. And if I could recommend something to help add some visuals to this, just take some notes on the names of the exercises. And if you look them up online, you should be able to see.
Yeah.
So
that's
blog.
The best way.
You'll be able to see it on our blog. You'll be able to see everything else.
Sure. So please don't describe them all.
Yeah. So I'll just give you the names. The strength movements are deadlifts and I guess renegade rows. And then the body weight.
Is there another name for that that you would suggest?
Push-ups with dumbbells.
Okay,
where you
perfect.
Pull the dumbbells, yeah.
Awesome.
Single leg squats, side planks and a bunch of variations, and then Spider-Man push-ups, which are just push-ups where you pull your knee up towards your elbow.
Awesome.
There it is.
Yeah, if you go to the Trainer Road blog, you'll be able to see that and get some insight into exactly what those look like. You'll even get to see Chad doing them. So.
And wait, we got to do the strength training disclaimer.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Chad, what are your beliefs on strength training with cycling?
That won't necessarily make you a faster rider. I mean, it'll make your body stronger, and that in and of itself could make you a better rider. But as far as strength gains coupling with endurance gains, that's a tightrope.
The one thing that I've noticed, and I was just watching some other video of us riding, is when I mountain bike, I need to lift some weights, man, because my upper body gets so tired. And you wouldn't go in the lab where I would like do squats and then have a higher FTP, but my upper body gets so tired on like long descents and stuff. And even in Grinduro that we did, like I can't hold it and then I slow down.
Yeah. You put a weak body on a bike. I don't know what else you'd expect.
Well, I'm not weak.
I'm not calling you weak exactly. I'm just saying a strong body can do a lot of things a weak body cannot.
Yeah.
One thing I really quickly want to applaud you on, and this is a good takeaway.
Wait, me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. All ears. you mentioned the fact that you get fatigued and then you slow down.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably why you don't crash. I see a lot of people get fatigued and they ignore that and they try to continue, and that's when bad things usually happen.
Are you saying I don't crash?
Well, I mean, you don't have like those severe, like, you know, really bad.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because the collarbone thing wasn't even your fault, right? So you haven't had anything that's massive like that. So
don't crash.
Yeah. Now, when do you want to work this in, ideally, Chad, in terms of strength training?
It's just such a loaded topic, but basically preseason is the best time to establish this different type of fitness, strength fitness. But the problem is a lot of cyclists will hit that off season really hard in terms of strength training, and then they don't do anything in the more competitive time of year, and all those gains dissipate. They don't just magically stay there. So there has to be some form of maintenance outside of the initial period.
Mm-hmm. Would you do them before a ride, after a ride, or that's different a time
one.
Of day?
That's a tough one. We've talked on on that too. Basically, the interaction of certain cell signals can work against one another.
mTOR.
And regardless of what they are exactly, I try to do the endurance and strength work about as far apart as you can get the two.
Okay, that makes sense. Ryan's question, he says, I travel a great deal, 40-ish weeks a year.
Oh,
holy cow. Oof. That's a lot. He says, I often find myself in hotel gyms with less than ideal equipment and no power meter option. I've thought about P1 pedals. Those are made by PowerTap, by the way, and the power meter is just built into the pedals themselves. But installing them seems like another barrier to getting the work done. My question is twofold. Number one, is moving workouts around in the week detrimental to the overall goals of the plan? I try to look for the tougher workouts and schedule them for when I am home. Let's address that one first. It is, I guess, shuffling it around. Is that bad, Chad?
No, it's no problem at all. You have to, make your training schedule fit your life schedule. The concern there is simply to not stack hard workouts too close to one another. Allow ample recovery, effective recovery.
Perfect. Makes sense. Number two, do you have any other suggestions on how to stay on track and get the most out of the training? He says, big fan. You guys have made a huge difference in my riding, and I plug your services whenever possible.
Yes, I have been testing. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have been testing traveling with a bike because I've not been here very much, right? I've had a whole bunch of travel, and I've tried every different way of how to get workouts in, almost every different way. I'm going to describe the different kind of situations you're in and then what I view as the best way.
Cool.
One is you're going to a place, a hotel with no, there's no opportunity. There's no bike, there's no gym, nothing like that. If I was a triathlete, I'd run, which would be great. But for an example for us, my family and I, we'd get the really cheap hotel when we go to Disneyland. My wife's really into working out too. So we actually bring our bikes and we use the Travel Track rollers, and we use a Vornado fan. A Vornado is like this really small fan.
Wait, Travel Track by Feedback Sports, you're saying, right? Yeah, so that's the Omnium that you use.
Oh, the Omnium.
Yep, that's correct.
So that one I can actually fit in my bike bag. Mm-hmm. I can fit the Vornado into my bike bag. And when you check these bikes in, at least in the airlines that I've been on, there's not the 50-pound weight limit. It's actually a 100-pound weight limit, and you just pay extra for the bike.
Gotcha.
And if you got to look at all the bike fees, because United is $150 each way, Alaska is $25. So for $25, you're like, oh, I could bring my bike and work out. So that's one thing, and it's the probably ideal for working out, but it's also the biggest pain and it's the most expensive. Again, too, the type of work, we'll get into the type of workouts in a second. I've also done it where I bring a P1 pedals, so any type of power meter pedals. The new Garmins, they don't have the pods on them, the Garmin Vector 3s, those would also be a great choice. A torque wrench, not torque wrench, just like Allen wrenches.
Yeah, and you also bring a pedal wrench too though, right?
A pedal wrench too, because whenever I go to these gym bikes, it's always different for how to get the pedals off. Some of them, a pedal wrench works, some of them they don't. And a lot of them have so much sweat on them, they're kind of rusted. So you need a pedal wrench. And make sure you figure out that you turn towards the back of the bike. Every gym bike that I've done this on, they're just like a cycling ones where they're threaded opposite each other.
You take the pedals off, you turn that wrench toward the back, right? You move the pedals backward if you put the wrench on. That's a good way to remember it.
Yeah, and backwards, yeah.
And then if you're putting the pedals on, you pedal the pedals forward.
Yep. And then I brought pedal grease. So when I put my pedals on, I don't want them to seize on. And then this gym bike now has $1,000 pedals.
That's a really good idea.
I've never asked for permission. Yeah. Oh, actually, no, I did once on a cruise. Yeah. But it was during a spin class, and the dude used to be a professional triathlete. So I was like, this guy will be cool.
Yeah.
And so that's a good example. On a cruise, I don't want to bring my gym bike. I can't bring my bike on a cruise. Yeah, and leave it in my room. So you can, if you put on the pedals and you have some sort of entertainment and trainer road on a mobile app, and if you can plug in a fan too, which is like the cherry on top. I know the fan is a lot more packing to bring, but it just lowers the RPE on the workout. Totally. That is my favorite way to ride is to use a gym bike. The only problem is that the gym bikes will be kind of weird where, you got to get your saddle height right. And I actually am going to bring a small Park Tools
tape measure.
Yeah. Cause if you get your saddle right, just right, it's great. The other thing is I've been on a bike where the saddle is totally tilted down.
Yeah.
And they require a different tool. They're not Allen wrenches. So I also suggest bringing like a little multi-tool and even like a crescent wrench. A crescent wrench or
pliers.
And what's that brand where they like, you can unfold them and they have like a little.
Oh, like a Leatherman?
Leatherman, yep.
Yeah.
Bring like a little Leatherman.
Yeah.
It's a little add to your weight for your packing, but then you can really adjust the bike how you want it.
Sure.
Can I recap really quick on equipment?
Yep.
So you would bring a multi-tool, a Leatherman. That multi-tool hopefully has Allen keys that you could use to get pedals off, but make sure that you have the right size.
I actually bring my own set of Allen wrenches because some of them might be really big.
Right.
And a multi-tool won't have that really big one.
In some, yeah, some multi-tools will have
pedals,
one that'll
especially.
Be big enough.
Yeah, it depends.
But yeah, it's a good safe bet. And then you bring a pedal wrench and you bring some grease.
Yeah.
That's how to put your pedals, power meter pedals, onto a gym bike.
Actually, the smarter way would be to pre-grease my pedals so
that's
I don't have to
point.
Bring a whole thing of grease down there.
Yeah, there
that's
go.
A good point.
Yeah. The other mistake I've made while traveling is I went and did a conference where business learning with a lot of drinking. I did workouts that were too hard. I did like an hour and 45 minute workout in my hotel room after a night of drinking. And I actually missed the whole next night because I was thrashed.
Right.
So I was trying to continue my high volume plan while I was down there. My question to you, Chad, is if I'm tomorrow I go to India for like 10 days and I plan on working out once every 3 days because I was thinking that is enough. And we actually already talked about this enough to maintain my fitness.
Most likely. Yeah.
What workouts should I do? What would be some workouts that you would recommend?
Yeah. So first off, they really don't need to be any longer than an hour. You could probably get away with less than that. But if you have an hour, then we picked out, three key workouts with mention of a fourth type. So Huffaker, or really any VO2 max workout. So especially when you get into that, roughly 120% of your functional threshold power for somewhere around 3 minutes has a lot of bang for the buck. So that's a safe bet. And if you could only do one workout, that'd probably be my recommendation. And then Nate's super fond of Mount Deborah, which I agree with him. It's a good workout. It's slightly super threshold. So it's in like 105 to 110 FTP range. And you repeat, I think they're 4 or 5 minute efforts. Are they that long?
Yeah.
3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And you get seven of them.
So they're short too, but you do many of them. So same thing, super threshold work. So we're looking for, a bit more bang for your buck, higher emphasis on intensity than duration. And then the third one is Haeckel, which is more of a sweet spot workout.
Yeah, that one steps up from just sweet spot, and then it just tips just at threshold and at the final interval in the set.
And those are also kind of shorter intervals. They're like 3 to 4 minutes long. Yeah.
But the point is, you're not going to get on there and just spin mindlessly at 60% of threshold for an hour. You actually want to make these meaningful workouts. So a bit of intensity is absolutely in line.
And if I was staying there longer, I'd actually repeat these workouts because they're all an hour long.
Yeah,
and an hour on a trip, like that's enough to. I have the mental energy to do that. The other thing that's important is when you go on these bikes, if you're on like a life fitness bike, it's hard to do like microbursts because you always have to like hit the button to adjust intensity.
And as much as I'd like to say do a microburst workout because there's so much to be gained from a workout of that nature, it would be really hard if you had to continually up adjust, down adjust, up adjust, down adjust.
Yeah.
The spin bikes too with the little knobs.
Yeah, the dial.
I've been on those and you can adjust it faster, but I've noticed that if you put any extra pressure at all on it, your watts change by like 60.
Yeah.
Like it's you can just kind of like rest a hand on it and it's 60 watts.
Yeah, I think a workout like that is a bit too technical to do on something that you have to manually adjust.
Mm-hmm. And then my last tip is doing long threshold efforts. It's hard to do those. Those take a lot of mental energy for me, at least. Hard to do on vacation and then or on any trip. Mm-hmm. Also, when we went to Disneyland, I just did 90 minutes of aerobic. So Disneyland, if those haven't been, it's a lot of walking. You're very tired each day.
Yeah.
So I did no intensity at all. I just want a calorie burn. And I think I did six Baxters in a row or something. So 60 minutes of, it was 90 minutes of aerobic, 6 days in a row. Hmm. And it allowed me mentally to think that I could eat more food because I just burned, you know, 1,200 calories.
And they have churros there. So
dude, churros. That. They have lots of stuff there.
But, you know, touching back on what Nate mentioned earlier is that you have to consider the nature of the travel. I mean, is this purely vacation? Is there going to be a lot of downtime, a lot of sitting on the beach, sipping Mai Tais, that sort of activity? Or are you going to a business conference? Is there going to be a lot of social interaction, late nights with drinking, poor sleep? All these things have to be factored in. You can't bury yourself in workouts and then expect to keep up with that sort of workload.
The other thing that I'm doing leading into my India trip is I'm doing a big week heading into it. I know I have, I'm lucky so I get to fly business points and stuff. We get to upgrade. So it's very nice. But it's 35 hours to get there. So I'm doing big days. And actually the day I leave, I'm going to do a big workout. And I'm going to plan on sleeping 12, 13, 14 hours on my first leg. On the plane.
Yeah, you can heap the stress on if you know there's going to be a really sufficient recovery block following it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good way to take advantage of it. Yeah.
And we're going to have a blog post about this. Yes, just keep checking blog.trainerroad.com.
Yep, you'll find it on there. Next question is from Ryan. He said, would there be anything wrong with starting sweet spot base mid-volume one, then moving to the high volume one version, and then high volume two, then progressing through the rest of the phases that you have on Trainer Road normally? The intention behind this is just to extend the base period. And just before we get into this, just to give people some background, we break our training into three phases, a base, build, and specialty phases. Base is 12 weeks, build is 8 weeks, specialty is 8 weeks. So in most cases, what people will do is that base phase, we break it up into two halves there, the sweet spot base one and two, depending on whichever volume you take, that would be the differentiator. But people usually complete both of those and then move on. So what this guy's doing is he's actually completing the mid volume one, then moving to high volume, and he's doing one again and then two. So extending that base period.
Yeah, so Ryan, you're basically taking a 12-week base period and extending it to 18 weeks, which normally I would say it would be a bit excessive if you were going a more traditional route where you were basically just logging long endurance miles. I think that the adaptation would have tapered off and you'd be doing a whole lot of extra work that wasn't seeing a lot of benefit. However, you're talking about sweet spot base, and in the case of the mid-volume plan, it's a really varied plan. Maybe not so much in sweet spot base one as two, but either way, you're getting more variety than a traditional go out and ride your bike for long durations. So it's a good start, and it's a good way to extend what you'd be moving on to, or your base period, before moving on to the high volume approach, which in the case of these high volume plans, they are exclusively sweet spot. So basically you're just kind of setting the stage and then moving on to a whole heaping of sweet spot stress over the course of the remaining 12 weeks. So I think it's viable, and I think you'll probably see improvements over the course of it, certainly in muscle endurance and primarily in that.
The other part of it is after sweet spot base mid volume, it's a gut check. Did I really hit all these workouts or was I spacing them out? Was I missing them? Do I really need the high volume? It was so cool to have Emmett on the podcast and have him tell everyone that he qualified for Kona on mid volume, right? And then sprinkled in extra workouts where he felt extra fresh. But like that was the base of his training.
Yeah, he played it smartly. He saw what he could handle, what his body could tolerate, and then, you know, leaving the option of more work later if he needed it, but he recognized that he didn't. He was seeing good adaptation. He was recovering well, and he was getting faster and stronger in the process. And
that was from episode 121. That was Emmett Kelly. He was an age grouper triathlete that qualified for Kona.
By the way, it was really cool to have all the, we were walking around Kona and users would walk up to us and say, I use Trainer Road's plan to qualify for Kona, like our triathlon plan.
Yeah.
And although we know we make people faster, that like one-on-one ability.
That's super cool.
It's pretty special.
If you guys want to make Coach Chad's day, like you should see him. He's walking, like Jonathan and I, we work on the product stuff, but the plans are actually all Chad.
Yes.
Coach Chad, excuse me. So if you want to make him happy, come up and tell him of like your experience with it. And I don't know. You're not grumpy, but you're just not. You're not bubbly and happy.
Yeah,
like you're just reserved. Even keel.
Yeah,
reserved.
I like reserved.
That's buy him a big beefy IPA. Tell him to use his plans, and the happiest dude on earth.
Or send me a good book. I've gotten a couple books lately, and that's as appealing as a beer.
Yeah. Awesome
almost.
Stuff.
Almost.
Next question. He says, hi guys, I could really use your help. I'm a 38-year-old father of three that recently found a passion for mountain biking, and even more recently, cross country mountain bike racing. Previously, cycling had been a method of keeping myself in shape for snowmobile racing. That's gnarly stuff, by the way. Those things weigh like a metric ton, and they're somehow wrestling them around.
No way.
Gnarly stuff. Yeah,
you always get the reports of those of like spinal injuries because they land on people.
It's pretty rough. Ultimately, I came to the realization that the dangers associated with snowmobile racing were too high for having a wife and children at home. The decision was made to step back from motorsports. Probably a smart move. I'm in the same boat, man. No worries. Since coming from a motorsports background where you have multiple lines to work with on a track and block passes are the norm, what is considered the correct way to pass an obviously slower rider in a single track type environment? We should probably explain block passes first, though, like that term.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's
I'm not a jerk.
Like,
just kidding. No, but tell, describe what it is.
Yeah, in motor sports racing, it's you basically block a person from continuing in the line that they are in. So you either do that by cutting their line off, but that's usually just called cutting somebody off. More commonly, a block pass is where you move them out of their line, if you know what I mean. So you get physical and make contact usually.
And this just happened to one of our pro riders here who works support at a cross race.
Yeah.
And it blew his mind. So what's the etiquette? Because he was like, that was BS and that shouldn't happen.
Yeah. No, it's tricky. I think that it is 100% okay to bump people as long as it's done carefully. As long as if you bump it, like even, you know, in a criterium, you get really comfortable with making contact with people but you make safe contact with people. And what I mean by that is that you're not at an angle that would cause them to really, you know, get pushed off their line.
It's going to happen, but it's seldom, if ever, malicious. You're not trying to crash anybody.
Well,
or
this guy did it, he thought, on purpose to our trainer employee, and our trainer employee went down. He said the guy actually leaned into him and knocked him off his bike.
Mm-hmm. Well, not okay.
This was at the very end of the race, so that it was like 200 meters to go.
So this is where things start to change. Okay, so my personal opinion on it is, on road riding, no, don't take anybody's line. You can put a hand on their shoulder or on their lower back and let them know they're there, that sort of a thing.
I don't like that. I just like saying, hey, I'm here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, but it's, you know, whatever you need to do to let them know that you're there, and you can even kind of ask them, like, you know, you can let them know that you're moving into a line.
And sometimes that hand on the hip actually deflects contact. I mean, otherwise you guys would come in contact. So it's not just a, hey, I'm here. It's also to kind of save the situation.
It's calming in a lot of situations versus a yell. Sometimes can cause.
A little
cause,
more subtle.
Yeah.
Just imagining Chad's hand on my hip.
Just a calm.
Yeah, calm hand.
Chad hand.
For the whole race.
But mountain biking, things are a little different. And when you're in a single track environment, you can't get by people without them yielding to you or without you getting off trail, which, number one, damages trails. Number two, makes you expend a huge amount of watts because you're usually going into terrain that's going to suck up your speed. Number three, is dangerous because you're going off trail. So who knows what you're going to come across. Number four, many times isn't even possible. So when you are a slower rider in front of somebody, I believe that it is your job to yield to that rider.
Depends.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, safety first.
I'm going to say the difference. As the slowest rider here and been passed the most, I'm going to say different situations.
Okay.
Okay. We're at some race and there's different race categories.
Uh-huh.
And this is like our enduro. People would come up behind me and this is the way that I like to be passed. People, they go, coming up, one behind you or something, or when you get a chance, and I immediately, as soon as I can, I pull over because I know this guy's screaming down.
You're different.
And then I love it when they say, thanks, man. Just like a thanks.
Yes.
I feel good there.
It's just polite.
Yeah.
Here's a situation where I don't think that it's necessary. You're in a cross-country race, and you are racing somebody else, and you beat them up the hill, and you're the first in the downhill, and then he goes, well, now I want to get in front of you and beat you on this downhill. There's a difference. There's one where you know that person's going to beat you, but if you've been battling the whole time, I view it's his responsibility to go harder on the climb and get ahead of me. It's just like the whole shot. It's the same thing with climbs. People get ahead of me in climbs, and I don't expect them to pull over. I should have won harder to go in front of that, and especially as you go higher in the ranks. I think that. But if there's a big discrepancy, or especially if they're not even in your group, just pull over immediately and let them go by.
So I'm gonna partially disagree with that. So let's say that you know that this person descending behind you, you beat somebody up to the top of a hill, it goes into single track, it's going downhill. Let's say that you know that that person doesn't have an advantage over you in descending, then I'm totally on board with what you said. But if it's a clear situation where they're going to be faster than you in descending, then I think that it's poor form to sprint ahead or cut off a line before you get to a descent just to block their line. I think that that's poor form.
Well, okay, maybe not sprint, but let's just say I just climb higher and I beat him by 20 seconds because I'm stronger.
Yeah.
And he comes up and then he comes up on me later.
Yeah, then that's a different case. You know, if you're...
I don't think it's not uncommon to outclimb a good descender. This mm-hmm. happens all the time. You're certainly not going to sit on their wheel and climb at their pace. You're going to have to go around it, but you know that catch is going to come. So
and this is too, if there's like, sometimes the trail gets bigger, I'll totally go to one side and let them by. I'm just saying if it's like single track and you're going fast, I don't like just stop in the middle of the trail and get off the trail. Like I wait for a spot. I don't try to block, but if it's a fat, like if Jonathan's behind me in a different category, I try to get off as soon as possible, even if it slows me down because they've got their own race going and
yes.
I shouldn't interrupt their race, I view.
If there's a person from a different category coming up behind you, there's zero excuse for not getting off the trail. Mm-hmm. Sorry, this is getting me upset. Like zero excuse because you're blocking a race that's not happening, but it's usually very dangerous because the person that's lapping through you is much faster. And you, if you try to stay in front of them, I can see it every time. If I catch that person and that person then isn't moving over, they end up riding over their head. They get preoccupied with the fact that somebody's faster behind them. They make more mistakes. It becomes mm-hmm. dangerous. And it's just, and then another bad thing is don't halfway pull over.
Yes.
Don't like halfway kind of roll to the edge of the trail and say go and go ahead. And then we both have to ride partially off the trail.
Yeah, you got
to
get out of the way. You got to move your bars.
Totally.
You have to make it.
Get off the trail, let them go, get back in. And you know what you can do then is you can try to follow their lines. You can try to do something like that.
Yeah.
And it's going to make you faster.
Yeah, there's a heck of a lot of benefit to following a faster descender.
Usually too, by the time I get on the bike, they're really far away because I didn't impede their progress to start with, but I can see their lines in the dirt because mm-hmm. they just made them and it's very fresh.
Yeah.
And I'm an expert tracker. Just kidding. No, what I do though, too, when you get off,
smart,
you pull over to the side and then I take one big step and then I pull my bike over.
If you can.
Exactly. Yeah, unless there's a cliff or something, you know, a ledge. But I always, like you don't just pull over, you take a big step and pull your bike over.
Yeah, sad fact of the matter is, though, that it's not always clean. I mean, sometimes you just...
You do your best.
Exactly. And it might be messy, but try to do the right thing.
Yeah, and genuinely try to do your best. Don't just, you know, let whatever happen and say you did try your best. It really is a big frustration point for me, especially this year. I had a lot of situations where just lap traffic, I was very shocked at the fact that there was zero effort to pull over. I was told many times, even this year, I was told at the Kamikaze Games by somebody, well, you can try to get around me if you're faster. And I was just like, we aren't even in the same division, man. Like, that's not helping anyone, you know, just.
That's just poor manners.
Yeah, exactly.
To go back to what I was saying too, situations I've been, it's like a loop course. Let's say it's a 2 minute climb and a 1.5 minute descent or something. And you'll go back and forth with the guy the whole time. But if it's like a 20 minute descent and at the beginning of the descent, someone's right behind me, I'll let him go by, even if we're battling. Yeah. But if it's like, you know, I can think in the cross race at Truckee Bike Park.
Right.
I'm pushing as hard as I can on that one. And then the descent is so quick that I'm not going to pull over if they get behind me.
No, not at all.
Like he should have gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a. Well,
and I also think a good point that we covered there is if you are close to a person at the top of a climb, then a decision point can be made that won't affect the outcome of the race in terms of like you pulling over if you're slower really isn't going to affect the race adversely too much for you. But if there's a big difference, like you said, you know, if you blow past the guy, who cares if he's a faster descender or not? But if you have, heck, if it's like 4 bike lengths, 5 bike lengths, that's fine, I think. But the thing that I was thinking of was in single track 6 on stage 1, there's a long climb toward the end, or not a long climb, but there was a climb toward the end and I was catching a guy rapidly. And he looked back, saw that I was catching him. He started sprinting. And then I got up next to him and he really started gassing it. So I'm gassing it. And I looked over and I said, what are you doing, man? Like, what are we doing here? Like, what's the objective? And then we went into single track and he cut my line off and then he wouldn't move over in the descent thereafter and was slowing things up.
It's frustrating.
And that's bad form. Like if you see somebody that's faster than you and they're coming up, I try to let them by. And even, you know, early on in a race, if it's a competitor that I'm with, I move over if they're faster than me. But when we get down to the end, you know, final couple kilometers, something like that, final descent, then I'm not going to move over. And that's okay, I think. Still, if it's somebody from a different division, I will move over. But if it's in the beginning of the race, yeah, I'm fine with letting them by. I don't want to affect their race.
And I do that too. As you get to a single track descent and I'm next to someone, almost always I can like look at them, and if they look like they can do anything, I'm like, you go first. It's okay.
Right.
Because it'll even make my descent faster.
Totally.
Because
will.
If I go ahead of them and then I pull over, mm-hmm. I'm going to be slower than if I just let them go.
And probably be panicked with the fast rider right on your, you know, right on your tail.
It's
going down.
It's like getting tailgated when you're driving on the freeway. You're just like, what's going on?
A couple of things. If there is a person in front of you, it is okay to, now this is tricky. You have to have a certain amount of bike skill to do this, but it is okay if they don't move to, and it's, this isn't like an aggressive thing or anything else like that, but it's okay to bump their tires. And this is like a battle that you're racing with somebody in your division. If you're battling closely, it's totally okay to ride in a section and to just, you know, buzz tread, right? You're not trying to knock them down. You're just trying to let them know that you're there, and that is okay.
Please, if you're behind me, just say, hey, when you get a chance. Yeah. And I always say, and I always acknowledge, I say, sure thing. And then within the next like 5 seconds, I'm over.
Once again, I'm saying in a close battle with somebody.
Yeah, the rules change when you get toward the pointy end of things.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
It's more gentleman's racing where I'm at versus Jonathan, and people are rah!
Well, and if you're catching somebody like big time, then yeah, don't buzz their wheel at all, right? There's no point in that. Like communicate with them, let them know you're coming up, that sort of a thing. But if you're in a tight battle, it's totally okay. And it's even common to see people brake check other riders when you're in a tight battle at the front like that. Or I shouldn't say brake check. They might happen to lose traction or slightly bobble right before a technical section. And, you know, you have to run. So it's not uncommon. But if you come into a situation in mountain biking where you can put a block pass on somebody, that implies that it's wide enough that you can have two riders side by side. You can totally take their line. That's just fine. But once again, that should be a close battle. If you're a lot faster than somebody or cutting up through a pack and this person is nowhere near your speed, then do so courteously. But if it's coming down to the wire and you're at the pointy end of a race or even at the back, but it's just a tight battle between two people, then you can be slightly more aggressive.
Just don't hurt anybody.
Yeah, exactly. That should never be your goal. If you ever think that, if in your mind your objective is to somehow cause them harm, you need to stop. That's not, you're racing a bike. You're not boxing. So hopefully that gives you some ideas on what to work with. You mentioned that you had the same struggles as all of us there. So hopefully that helps. Chris, he says, hi, Trainer Road. I'm new to Trainer Road and feel really motivated after the first 2 weeks. Still a long way to go, but so far so good. The different drills have highlighted how much there is to learn and gain, even though I have an okay power to weight ratio of around 4 watts per kilogram. That's awesome, man.
That's not okay.
That's more than okay.
It's really good. He says, what are your thoughts on Trainer Road combined with Reformer Pilates? Chad, and he says, thanks, Chris, from Cold Denmark. Do you have some experience with Pilates?
Yeah, I'm actually Pilates certified. This harkens back to my younger days, but I did teach Pilates classes. And Reformer Pilates are basically just Pilates done on, it's kind of a wooden sled that's spring resisted. There's ropes and there's all sorts of tools and whatnot. But basically this is just exactly what we were talking about with strength training, is a stronger body is a more capable body. And Pilates is one method to go about achieving that stronger body. So I do think there's benefit in it. I don't think it's necessarily going to make you a faster rider, but I do think, again, it will make you a fitter person, a stronger, more complete, a better rounded athlete.
A lot of it's core stuff too, which is...
It's predominantly core.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which could help.
For sure.
Yeah. We see a lot of people asking questions about, you know, weightlifting and everything else. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see a question.
Yes. This is more of a body weight exercise.
We've got a pro tip too.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. For the single gentleman, go to a reformer Pilates class. There will be opposite.
It draws a specific crowd.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
So if you're single and you like that sort of thing, you want to be another fit person who cares about fitness.
Better yet, be a Pilates instructor.
Chad, was that? Yeah. That's the only reason, Chad.
He's smiling like that's
what there is a method to my madness.
Gotcha. Okay. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And please submit your questions for next week. We've got a lot to get through after being gone with Kona and everything else, but we'll comb through them and put them into the feed next time. You can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast. If you have any curiosities about stuff that we've mentioned today, you can send in questions there or check out our blog, blog.trainerroad.com, and you can get more information there as well. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.